Okay, back now with Isaac Silk, who's been reporting on how the government has worked to affect lifestyles through legislation. We're covering a lot of ground here, Isaac, considering these different so-called sin taxes. So what does the latest debate over how to handle obesity fit in with the lasting discussion over how to handle lung cancer and smoking?
Well, the two are related conceptually as health issues, but they're not as similar as you might think, and research bears this out. Men who smoke a pack of cigarettes a day have a relative risk of mortality nearly 4 times higher than the national average. The relative risk of mortality from obesity isn't even close to that. It's 1.5 times higher than average.
4 to 1.5, it's not very similar.
Not really. But for healthcare advocates, there are a lot of lessons to be learned from how activists and the government work to stamp out smoking. To learn more about that, I spoke with Dr. Stan Glantz. He's the director of the UCSF Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education. And to start with a comparison, here's what he has to say about the Richmond soda tax.
I think the measure to tax sugary drinks, which is starting out here in California, Richmond's a great idea. It's really modeled on the success that we had with the early clean indoor air movement at the local level. Whether it wins or loses in Richmond, the fight is joined. And the more discussion there is of these issues, the more debate of these things there are, the more the public gets educated. And it was a series of losses that we suffered in the late 70s, early 80s, that really laid the foundation for all the progress on tobacco since then. And I think that the same is true in the soda tax issue. I mean, sugary drinks are a huge public health problem. And taxation is a proven way to reduce consumption. And the debate over the tax is a great way to educate people. So, you know, whether the people in Richmond will succeed or whether the corporate interests that control the soda industry defeat them in this campaign, who knows?
That's Stan Glantz, who directs UCSF's Center on Tobacco Control Research and Education. So when he talks about corporate interests, Isaac, they do wield a lot of power.
Because they have a lot of money. We just have to look back a few months to the fate of Prop 29.
It would have added a dollar a pack tax to cigarette sales.
Right. And early on, it led in the polls by a lot. But when Big Tobacco threw its wallet against the measure, support started to erode. They spent nearly $50 million on a No on 29 campaign. And then the measure failed.
By a sliver.
Just enough. But advocates like Stan Glantz think you just have to keep coming with the legislation. It's interesting to hear about how the anti-smoking movement developed in California. It got its start right here in Berkeley. Here's what he told me about the history of California's anti-smoking campaigns.
Well, the whole story in California started in the late 70s when a few people started thinking that they didn't want to breathe secondhand smoke, that secondhand smoke was indoor air pollution, and that people should have a right to go about their lives without breathing it. And that group tried to get a law passed in Berkeley, which they did, which created non-smoking sections in restaurants. That was viewed as pretty radical for the day to say that you can only smoke in certain places. They then went to the state legislature to try to get a law passed for the state to, again, simply create no smoking sections, something that by today's standards would be considered a complete sellout to the tobacco companies. But by then, the tobacco industry had really realized they had a problem in California and was up in the legislature in force with their lobbyists, with their campaign contributions, and the effort was blocked. That led that group to try the initiative route, and they introduced an initiative in California in 1978 called Proposition 5, again, to simply create non-smoking sections. The tobacco companies came in, spent millions of dollars, more money than in every other state election in the state that year, and defeated this initiative, claiming it was unreasonable, that it infringed on freedom, that it was a nanny state, that while secondhand smoke was a problem, the initiative itself was flawed. And in the end, it started out ahead, way ahead, and then the industry beat it back and defeated it. I got involved late in that campaign personally. We tried again in 1980, the same thing happened. And then we realized that we just didn't have enough money to take on the tobacco companies in a state initiative campaign, that the tobacco companies owned the legislature, And so we went to working at the community level and started getting local ordinances passed around the state. By 10 years later, we had about 85% of the state covered by strong local legislation. In the mid-1980s, the Surgeon General issued the first report on secondhand smoke, saying secondhand smoke caused lung cancer and that simply having separate sections wasn't good enough. And then the movement went toward having smoke-free environments, which we enjoy today.